So, hi everyone. Today we're having a lecture on the second lecture on peer effects, and this will keep us busy for the first 1.5 hours. Right. So we stopped 2 weeks ago. Or was it 1 week ago? I don't remember. We stopped the last lecture with the model, the theoretical model of peer effects. A very simple model in the Falk and Echino paper published in the Journal of Labor Economics in 2006. This is compulsory reading. Is it? No, it's not. But I meant to make it compulsory reading, but I just forgot to put the star. Never mind. If there's no star in the lecture slides, it's not compulsory reading. But, of course, to the extent that I will cover this paper in the slides, it will become exam relevant. So, just to avoid any misunderstandings. Now, the model is very simple, and yet it has enough structure to generate three important predictions. So, prediction number one, if peer effects are positive, the difference between individual behaviors with peer effects will be smaller than the difference between individual behaviors without peer effects. Now, what does positive peer effect mean? Right. So once again, what does positive peer effect mean? Positive peer effect mean a positive correlation between your behavior and the behavior of the people you are in together in a group. Right. So positive peer effects does not always mean that you're going to learn something positive from your peers. Right. Positive peer effects mean that your behavior is going to be positively correlated with whatever behavior these guys are exhibiting. Right. So if you end up in a group of smokers, then chances are that your likelihood of becoming a smoker will increase as well, even though this is not positive is not what usually regarded as positive behavior. Now, so that's prediction number one. Prediction number two, positive peer effects increase the average output, right? So the prediction number two basically tells us that if you can harness the peer pressure in the environment where behaviors are positive and productive, then the productivity, the average productivity of the two people in the group, or by extension several people in the group, is going to increase. And this term, 1 over 1 minus beta, is known as the social multiplier. So what is this social multiplier? It's the reciprocal of 1 minus the correlation between individual behaviors. If individual behaviors are strongly correlated, so peer effects are strong, then the social multiplier is going to be very large. If the social multiplier is very large, then the productivity effects of peer pressure are going to be very, very strong. Now, and the third prediction from the maths of the model is the difference between peer and single output is higher for less productive individuals. So what does this say? It says that, well, if you take a group of high-performing individuals and low-performing individuals and enable peer effects in this group, then the high-performing individuals will take it easy, will reduce their output, okay? So, and that's not necessarily very good, but the low-performing individuals will increase their output by so much that it will overcompensate the output decrease of the high-performing individuals, right? So the less productive you are, the lower your individual behavior is before enabling peer effects, the higher will be your increase, the increase in your behavior when peer effects are enabled, right? So the individual whose productivity is lower, whose own productivity is lower, will react to peer pressure more strongly. Now, so these are the three predictions from the model. What is the empirical evidence? What is the empirical evidence to support these predictions? Now, this is a very interesting paper. it has this model, and it also has a very interesting statistical analysis of the results that are related to this model. You don't get very many studies, empirical studies, looking only at the behavior of 24 subjects in the experiment that get published in a top field journal these days. So it's such a beautifully made paper that I think, you know, I believe it well deserves being published in a top field journal. But it's a relatively small scale experiment. Now, so the beginnings are quite standard, but the statistical analysis is quite special. So they hired a bunch of students. They paid them a fixed wage, so no incentives. This was done on purpose because if you want to look at peer effects, you have to try to switch off all other channels, prevent them from interfering into the effects that you want to discover. So fixed wage, 4 hours. Now, then things become a bit more interesting. The first question that the authors had to address in their experimental design was, how do you enable peer effects? Or how do you disable peer effects, right? So you need to have a treatment in which peer effects are present, and you need to have another treatment or control in which peer effects are not present, right? So how do you turn on the peer effects? So now, how do you turn on the peer effects? This is the control treat. This is the control group. This is the situation in which no peer effects are possible. What does prevent peer effects from happening? The surest way of preventing peer effects from happening is to have no groups, right? So if you have a group, even if there is no interaction in the group, maybe people may have some awareness of others and that can act as a quasi-peer effect. So the authors, given the small sample size, would have none of it. And so therefore, they said, okay, guys, you're going to work alone. So in the control treatment, 8 people who were randomly selected in this treatment were placed in in cubicles where they would work alone. No peer effects possible. Now, how do you enable peer effects? The minimum thing you need to do to enable peer effects is to create groups, right? So in the peer effects treatment, they had groups. They randomly selected 16 people into the peer effects treatment, and they randomly broke them down into pairs. So 16 subjects, 8 pairs. Now, two participants in a pair work in the same room with their desks located next to each other. So you see, so here's your desk, here's my desk, and we see each other and we see how hard we work, right? There's a pile of forms that need to be filled in, and there's another tray where you put in your filled in forms. So you could see each other's tray and you could see how productive you are. So this was the environment in which the authors were hoping to catch peer effects. So subjects can easily observe the output of the other subject. You need this output observability because, look, if you want to see peer effects, you need to see, you need to make sure that subjects can observe each other. Okay? So, now, what happened? So, there are a couple of results. What happened? Now, result number one, the standard deviation of output within pair is lower than between pair. What does it mean? You take the 8 people in the single treatment, no peer effects, you take the 8 people and you calculate the standard deviation of their output. So somebody filled in 30 forms per hour, other filled in 50 forms per hour, you calculate the standard deviation, bang, this is the standard deviation in the control group. Now, then you calculate the standard deviation within pairs in the treatment group and you compare it with the standard deviation in the control group and you see a significant difference. Now, but look, you have 8 people in the control group and 8 pairs, 16 people in the treatment group. Statistically speaking, comparing standard deviations on such small samples is a difficult thing to do. How did the authors do it? Well, they used combinatorics. They generated they said, okay, let's suppose there's no peer effects. Let's suppose there's no peer effects. Then let us hypothetically, not actually, but hypothetically rearrange all the 16 subjects in our peer effects treatment into pairs with each other, all possible pairs with each other. And for each rearrangement, we're going to calculate the within-group standard deviation of their output. So there's going to be 100 and there's going to be 105 possible rearrangements of 8 participants in the single treatment into 4 pairs. So it's just combinatorics. So for each of these 105 possible rearrangements, you calculate the within-paired standard deviation, and you will have 105 observations. Sorry, 105 numbers. Each of them corresponds to within-paired standard deviation. You plot their distribution. You plot their distribution, and you compare this distribution with the within-pair, with the actually observed within-pair standard deviation in the treatment group. And what you see is that the chance of finding a low within-pair output variability in the absence of peer effects is less than 1%. So there's less than 1% chance that the within-peer standard deviation in the singles treatment, that is, the treatment without peer effect, is going to be as low as the actually observed standard deviation in the peers treatment. So this is not your typical econometrics. This is actually, it's not voodoo, right? It's a scientific method, but it's a very interesting scientific method used in this unique setting. You just calculate the actual distribution, and you make your statistical inferences with respect to the actual distribution rather than the hypothetically assumed normal distribution or T distribution or F distribution or what have you, you know, all these stable distributions. Now, so result number one, there is lower, significantly lower variability of the within-pair productivity results, so within pair output in the peer effects treatment than in the control treatment. Now, how does this result one relate to the predictions of the model? Look here. Prediction one of the model says that the difference between individual behaviors is going to reduce, is going to get lower when you enable peer effects. If the difference between individual behaviors in the pair is going to get lower once you switch on the peer effects, the within-pair standard deviation of output is also going to get lower, right? So if you find the significant decrease in the within-pair standard deviation, then this is consistent with prediction one. So prediction one of the model is supported by result one. Now, result two corresponds to prediction two of the model. Prediction two of the model says that the average output with peer effects is going to be higher than the average output without peer effects. So it's an easy to check. You calculate the average output in the control group. You calculate the average output in the treatment group. You compare them. So the control group, the average output was 190, whatever. The treatment group average output was 221. Okay. So this is a 16% difference. And doing a similar exercise, doing a similar combinatorics exercise, basically plotting the empirical distribution of output in the control group and comparing the actual average from the treatment group to the possible distribution of output in the control group, they find that this difference is statistically significant, which validates prediction two. So let's do a little bit of structure. Let's try to learn about the implied parameters of the peer effects model from the data. Now, assuming the average output in the peer effects at 221 and the average output in the control group at 190, so this is with peer effects, this is without peer effects, you can actually use the expression in prediction two. So this is the average output with peer effects, 221. This is the average output without peer effects, that is 190. You can solve this equation using the data and calculate beta, the social multiplier, to be equal to 14%. So what does it mean? It means that if you're put together, if you're put together two different people into a group, then if one of them increases their output by one unit, the other will increase their output by 0.14 units. Okay, so the total output of the group will increase by more than what individual output increase would predict. Okay, so that's actually quite important for personnel management, because the implication for personnel management of this result says that, you know, you should put people of different productivity together. Yeah. Why? Good question. Why is it already taken into account? Because it follows from the equilibrium behaviors already. And there, the multiplication is already taken into account. Yeah. Okay, so that's result number two, very important result. Now, result number three. Result number three corresponds with prediction number three. What does prediction number three of the model tell us? It tells us that if you put a high performer and the low performer together in a group with peer effects, then the low performer's change in output is going to be bigger than the high performer's change in output. The high performer will probably rest on their laurels a little bit, will go down, but the high performer's output is going to surge more than the decrease of the low performer. So that gives you, related to prediction two, that gives you increase in the average output. And that's what we see. Productivity differences between pair and single treatments are stronger at the bottom of output distribution. So they built output distribution in the treatments. This is the distribution of outputs in the single treatment. These are the outputs generated by the eight people randomly selected into the no peer effects treatment. This is the distribution with the same quantiles in the pair treatment, and they just calculated the difference by quantile. And what you find is that the difference in the peer effects compared to no peer effects case is higher for relatively underperforming individuals, right? Notice that output is not only the function of others' behavior, it's also the function of your own productivity. See this? So beta is assumed to be the same for everybody. And yes, holding everything constant, there is a correlation between others' output and your output. But prediction 3 is not about beta. Prediction 3 is about theta. Right? And what prediction 3 says is that depending on the value of the theta, the peer effects for you can be stronger or less strong. For low thetas, the peer effects are going to be stronger than for high thetas. So top performers, the high theta people, will not react to peer effects very strongly. The low performers, the people with low theta, will react to peer effects more strongly. That's what prediction 3 says. Okay. And, well, there you are. This is your theta. Really, because in the single treatment there are no peer effects. Beta is equal to zero, right? So if you compare, this is the productivity, if you like, the productivity distribution in the no peer effects treatment. This is the productivity plus peer effects distribution in the peer effects treatment. Okay, so assuming that the underlying productivity distributions are the same by treatment, which assumption makes sense because of the randomization. So this is theta plus peer effects. This is only theta. Let's calculate the implied peer effects by quantiles of productivity distribution. And this is the implied peer effects by quantile of productivity distribution. And what you see is super productive people do not really react to peer effects. The not-so-productive people do react to peer effects very strongly. So, low-productivity subjects show stronger reaction to peer pressure, which is what prediction 3 is telling us. So, your question is, your question is not about these data. Your question is not about these data. Your question is about a hypothetical situation. Your question is, what's going to happen if you have somebody with a very high theta put together with somebody with a very low theta. Okay. Good. Interesting. So let's have a look. Well, so suppose individual I has very high theta and individual j has very low theta. What the hell? Let's normalize theta j to zero. Okay, so let's say this is the lowest possible, the most hopeless individual you put together with. Okay, so before peer effects, you would have individual I being producing a lot of output because theta I is very high, and individual j producing zero output because theta j is equal to zero. Now, how much is individual I going to produce after peer effects? Let's calculate. So, with peer effects, beta is above zero, right? So, theta j is zero. Okay, so that's going to be zero. How much is xi's output going to be? The xi's output is going to be his past output divided by something which is less than one. So it's also going to increase. I think I said something wrongly some minutes ago in the lecture, but this was wrong. I don't have a very sharp recollection of what exactly I said. It's all video recorded, but I think I may have said something to say that when you put together a high productive individual and low productive individual, and high productive individual will go down. That's not true. It's not true, at least mathematically. So we're not in the world of recognition. In the world of recognition, the high productive will go down. We know it from the past lectures, right? But here, the output of the high productive individual is not going to go down. It's going to go up, right? Now, what will happen to the output of the low productive individual? Well, the output of the low productive individual will clearly go up because, okay, theta j is zero, but theta I is very high. So the output of the low productive guy is going to go up pretty strongly, right? It's still not going to be as highly productive as the high productive individual, because the output of the high productive individual is going to be theta I divided by 1 minus beta squared, whereas the output of the previously low productive individual is going to be theta I times beta times 1 over 1 minus beta squared. And as long as beta is between 0 and 1, we don't know this, by the way. All we know is that beta is equal to more than 0. But if beta is between 0 and 1, which is realistic and is consistent with what the empirics are telling us, that then the low productive individual is not going to work as hard as high productive individual. But the delta in performance is going to be higher for the low productive individual. This is how much harder the high productive individual will work. Can beta be negative? Theoretically, yes. There's nothing that prevents beta from being negative. Well, so there are two questions. Question number one, can beta be negative? The answer to this question is yes, theoretically beta can be negative. Let's see if it makes sense, beta being negative. So let's just, this is high productive, this is low productive, beta negative. If beta is negative, then the high productive is going to work less hard after peer effects, but the low productive is going to work even less hard because beta is negative. So beta being negative is a theoretical possibility, but this theoretical possibility doesn't make a lot of sense. And in particular, beta being negative does not explain the observational result that some people may refer to, that says that when you put together a high productive individual and low productive individual, the average output will go down. So the model is not addressing this. So can you give us an example that you're thinking of? But the example in which when you put together high and low productive individuals, the high productive individual will work less hard. It's a completely different world. Well, there is at least one difference. Maybe there are more differences, but you know. So the example that Florian gave to us is okay. He says, let's imagine a group project for which the grade is shared between the team members, right? And there are high productive participants and low productive participants. And Florian tries to apply this peer effects model to this environment. And he says, well, I notice from my experience that sometimes the high productive individuals will work and the low productive individuals will shirk. But this is free riding, no? Yes? And so far we've come to a conclusion that, you know, we're discussing an example in which this model doesn't make sense. And the example in which this model doesn't make sense is the example in which there is a group work and the low productive individuals are not working hard. In fact, they work less hard. Is this a fair summary of your example? Yes. Well, recall free riding. Here... Well,
they just see what each other is producing.
Exactly. So this is a production function. There's no incentives there. In fact, that's quite important that there's no incentives there. And that's what the authors did. There's a fixed wage. Okay. So we're talking about purely behavioral effects. We're talking about purely non-incentivized effects. Now, in your example is different from this world, quite different.
Yeah.
Because in your example, you don't get a fixed grade. Your grade depends on your effort. Well, not only your individual effort, but also of the efforts of the other people. And that introduces an element of free riding, which is what we saw in the team's lecture. Right? So... I don't think that you can argue yet that this model doesn't make sense because look at what happens in teamwork when less productive people work less hard. So, I'm thinking about examples. I don't want to spend too much time on this because we've got other things to do, but we have a lot of time. So let's think a little bit for a difference, you know, rather than just talking lecture slides. Let's think a little bit. So I can sort of imagine examples from the world of education where you put together, you know, well-performing pupils and so-called problem pupils in a class. And problem pupils in the class, they exhibit a negative influence on the performance of previously high-performing pupils. This model would predict that the high-performing pupils will not lose anything in their performance. The high-performing pupils will actually work even harder. But the low-performing pupils will greatly improve their performance, depending on the strength of the peer effects, which is not always what we observe in reality. So I think the classroom example, where problem kid exhibits negative influence on the performance of good pupils. I think it's an example that is a stronger example against the validity of this model. And to be honest, I don't know how to rationalize it in terms of this model. I think that this model cannot rationalize this example. But with the help of our Wirtschaftspädagogik friends who participate in this lecture, maybe we can rationalize it. So what is happening? With peer effects in the classroom. My question was, how do you or can you rationalize the bad people affecting negatively the performance of good pupils within this model? Can this model predict bad pupils negatively affecting the performance of good pupils? Yes or no? It might be useful to look in your lecture slides. so that you would see all the equations together. What do you think? Can this model predict bad pupils negatively affecting the performance of good pupils?
Just this.
Just this model.
Just affecting a negative beta would affect?
No. That's precisely the point. You know, that brings us back to the point of negative beta. Negative beta is not going to make this prediction.
Why not? Because if...
Oh, okay, let's see. Ah, okay, okay, so...
It depends because it has two effects. On the one side, the denominator gets smaller, and the numerator as well, what increases the total output. But which effect is stronger depends on the height of beta, doesn't it?
Actually, let's think. Actually, so let's hold beta positive. Let's hold beta positive. And let's do some comparative statics. What is the sign of the derivative of, so let's say I is the good pupil and J is a bad pupil, so to say. Right. So, what is the sign of the derivative of xi with respect to theta j? Positive, thank you. Positive, what does it mean? It means that if theta goes down, xi also goes down. So if you have two good pupils together, let's say their thetas are exactly the same. Okay? If thetas are exactly the same, let's say they're equally good, right? So then they will still influence each other through their peer effects. And what will be the performance? What will be their performance after they're put together? Their performance after they're put together is going to be theta times beta divided by 1 minus beta squared. We're not sure if it's higher or low. But let's just fix it. Okay. Now, let's now say that you put together let's say that theta j is now going down. So theta j goes down now, right? What will be the performance of I? Will it be higher or lower than before? Lower. So, good pupils together, this much of a performance. The only thing that's going to change is that now let me reduce the quality of the second pupil in the group. So now we have lower theta. The performance of the good pupil will go down. Do you see why it will go down? You see why it will go down? It's trivial, right? So you can explain with this model what will happen when the structure of the class changes for the worse. So you have a class, a certain set of thetas, and then, you know, some of the good pupils went to other schools and you have some new pupils coming and these pupils are awful, let's say, okay? What will happen as a result of this change in the class? What will happen to the performance of the remaining pupils in the class? This performance will go down. So this actually, now that I think about it, and it's the first time I think about it. So it's I think, at least for me, it's been great and very useful discussion. So I used to think that this model was sort of was so badly and inadequate to predict peer effects in the classroom, but actually, it's not that bad, because what it does predict is what happens if you have an exogenous change, negative change in the composition of abilities in the class. Then it will have a negative effect on the performance of the remaining pupils in the class. So what this model does not predict? Well, no, the model does predict this. No, it's good. So you have what does okay? So let's see what is the let's see what this model does not predict. Let's say there was a very good pupil, top theta, right? So his performance or her performance was very high before peer effects when they were working on their own. Now, so they were working on their own, and then their cousin from Hamburg came, and they are now sharing a bedroom and a study room in their house. And the cousin from Hamburg is a horrible, very disruptive, bad performing pupil, doesn't care about studying, doesn't care about nothing. What will happen to the performance of the previously top pupil now that they are sharing facilities together? What's going to happen according to the model? According to the model, the prediction is not quite clear. But if that cousin has a very negative theta, suppose this theta is very negative, what's going to happen to the Xi? Will it go up or will it go down?
Depends on the beta.
But let's say beta, okay, so surely holding a beta fixed, as long as beta is less than 1, right? Holding beta fixed, you can find a negative enough theta to ruin the performance of the good pupil. It just depends on the beta. It's not very clear. It's not very clear. If beta is 0, let's say, if beta is 0, there's no peer effects. So it doesn't matter how horrible the cousin from Hamburg is, right? It doesn't matter. Your performance will always be the same because beta is 0. Now, let's say beta now is very high. So if beta is very high, what's going to happen is, on the one hand, you're going to have this very powerful multiplier effect acting here, okay? And that boosts performance. On the other hand, if beta is very high, you're going to have a very strong influence from the horrible, from this horribly low theta. It would be interesting, just for fun, you know, when you are preparing this lecture for the exam or something, it would be interesting to plot the in a three-dimensional space. It would be interesting to plot the reaction of the performance of person I to peer effects depending on theta j and beta, and see what are the regions of the theta j and beta when this performance effect is positive or versus when this performance effect is negative. I think what is quite clear is holding the beta constant, you can find the negative enough theta to ruin the performance as a result of peer effects. And holding the theta constant, you can find a beta that is strong enough to... Wait a moment. Holding a theta constant, can you find a beta that is strong enough to improve the performance? Yeah, that's right. As long as beta is strictly less than 1. Yeah, try it out. Looks like an interesting exam question. So let's summarize this part, unless there are further questions. So we started by saying, hey, that doesn't make sense. What doesn't make sense? Well, we've seen in reality that there are also negative peer effects, that the performance of previously good people suffers as a result of their exposure to, you know, to bad influences. This can happen in two contexts, both of which we've discussed. Context number one, teamwork. And context number two, this bad pupil in the class. So context number one is not very relevant here because there we have negative effects happening through incentives mechanism as well as peer effects mechanisms. So free riding, for example. Context number two is more interesting. So in context number two, the question is, can you rationalize a deterioration in performance of previously good pupils now that some very bad influencing pupils are added to their class, yes or no? And the answer seems to be a tentative yes, Because if you look at the performance, at the post-peer effects performance of the previously good pupil, it can go down, given the beta, it can go down if the badness of peers is strong enough. So, yeah, I think the model is good. I think the model does rationalize negative peer effects as well, depending on the values of the theta. Okay, so let's move on. Yeah, open issues. Now, they say it's clean evidence on peer effects. They say, and it's as I said, it's a wonderful paper, right? Andrea Aquino, we did another paper by Andrea Aquino, you know, this Quarterly Journal of Economics paper about the Italian bank. Remember this? Last lecture? So Armin Falk is, of course, one of the most famous German economists. But there are a couple of open issues. Now, number one, they say it's clean evidence on peer effects. Some people don't think so. Some people don't think that it's very pure, clean evidence on peer effects. Because remember, what was the difference between the control treatment without peer effects and the peer effect treatment? What was the difference? There are two differences. Number one, the peers could see each other. They could see each other, and their seeing each other would enable peer effects. What was the other difference between the peer effects treatment and control? What was the other difference? The other difference? What was the other difference?
It was just alone.
Exactly. So in the control treatment, people were alone. Now, there are studies that shows that just that performance can be affected beyond peer effects. It can be affected just by the presence of other people. We saw this in the large stakes, big mistakes experiment, I think, which we... Did we do the negative effects of incentives in this semester, or was it winter semester? Was it this semester or last semester? So this large stakes, big mistakes paper, choking under pressure and such like. Last semester, right. So the very presence of the audience, if you like, can affect people's performance beyond peer effects. Okay. So one of the difference between the treatments was the right difference. The first treatment, no peer effects. The second treatment, yes, peer effects. Let's calculate the difference and see, there are peer effects. But there was a second difference. And this difference was that in the control treatment, they were alone. In the peer effects treatment, they were in a group. Maybe it was the group environment that affected their performance as well as peer effects. Okay? So the difference on the evidence on peer effects in this particular paper is not extremely clean. Now, also a related question is, if we are talking about a combination of two effects, the peer effect plus the presence of the others, how much of the total effect is driven by peer effects, which is the information about the other workers' productivity? And how much of this effect is driven by the very presence of the other worker? Maybe physical appearance of the other workers also matter. Maybe they could talk to each other, you know, which they were not allowed to, but they could, right? So it's not clear how much of this effect is peer effects. What are the mechanisms? And the most important question, and of course this question was beyond the scope of the paper, so I'm not saying it's criticism, it's just an open issue. The really important question is, okay, let's assume there are clean peer effects, clean evidence on peer effects. What is the mechanism? What is the mechanism? What is it that happens that conveys peer effects? Right? So any effect that we observe in the real world has to have a mechanism behind it. What's the mechanism behind chemical reactions? Well, it's the interactions between atoms in different molecules. That's what chemistry is studying, right? What's the mechanism behind force of gravity? It's the Higgs boson particle that has recently been discovered. Right? So there's always a physical mechanism that delivers a certain effect. And the clean evidence on peer effects paper is a bit silent on this. Now, here's a very famous paper by Alexander Maas and Enrico Moretti that is so famous because there's a lot going for this paper, but one reason why it's very famous is because it tells us about mechanisms behind peer effects, and it's very important to learn about such mechanisms. Now, this is clearly a compulsory reading, so please download it and read it. It's a great paper. The question that they ask is peer effects. So the big research question is, let's try to estimate peer effects. But their methodology is completely different from Falk and Bikino. They didn't have an experiment. They didn't have a clear control group and clear treatment group. What they did have is they had changes in the composition of a work shift. Basically, changes in the composition of people working together with each other at the same point in time. That's what they had. And when you have some people come, other people go, you see that your exposure to peers of different quality changes in time, and if there are peer effects, then your productivity also has to change in lockstep with the productivity of the people who you work with. So it's a little bit like the Italian bank study design, but it's much better identified. So the paper looked at supermarkets, which makes my research heart tick. I like retail for research. 394 cashiers in a network of supermarkets. They had their cash till records over 2 years. Millions of observations. That's what they call big data. Now you have billions of observations like this. So firms are sitting on terabytes of data, all these cash till records, which are not used beyond, you know, basic accounting, which could tell you an interesting story. So, very familiar setting. You know, you've been to supermarket. Each transaction, each product that you buy gets transacted. It gets, you know, you hear the click sound. It gets recorded in the system. Then you get your bill and you walk away. Right? Now, what happens with these transactions? These transactions are analyzed by guys like Maas and Moretti. And how would you measure the productivity of a worker in a retail environment, the productivity of a supermarket cashier? What's your measure of productivity of supermarket cashier? The number of clicks per second is an excellent measure of cashier productivity. Right? So if you're a good cashier, you're going to do click, 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 very quickly. If you're not so good, you're going to do click, 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 click. Now, suppose you are a slow cashier and next to you sits a very fast cashier who does click, 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 click. Question is, will you start clicking faster or about the same? Just because there's a cashier next to you that works very hard. Another question is, suppose you are the fast clicking cashier and next to you sits someone who is very slow. What happens to your productivity? That's another question, right? So yet another question is, suppose you sit at your cash desk and you have a cashier who you observe, who is next to you. You see how productive this cashier is. And this cashier also sees how productive you are. And, you know, in the other end of the, somewhere in the other corner of the room, there's another cashier who may be productive or not very productive, but neither you see them nor they see you. Question is, what is the effect of the cashier sitting next to you on your productivity as opposed to the effect of the cashier sitting at a distance from you on your productivity? And it looks like a trivial question, right? And it is a trivial question, but it still takes some effort to find the answer to this question. And the answer to this question may be quite informative. So, basic model, here's your productivity. Notations, some of the notations are very similar to Falk and Dikino, so it's easy to, you know, talk about these papers interchangeably. So here's your productivity. It's a function of your ability, if you like, theta. It's the same thing as in the Falcon de Kino. It's how productive you are. But it's also the function of the productivities of the people who work with you, the average of these two, or of these productivities. So notice the slight difference here. The Falcon de Kino says your productivity is a function of your ability and the productivity of others. The Mas and Moretti say that no, it's the function of your ability and the abilities of the others. This is a small difference. I don't think it's very substantial, but it is a difference that I think needs to be paid attention to. So the two papers are not directly comparable, but they are to a large extent comparable. So how do you estimate peer effects? What is the parameter that gives you the strength magnitude of peer effects? Just like in Falcon de Kino, this is the beta parameter. So the prize in the game is to estimate this beta. How do you estimate this beta? Well, what the authors do, they say, okay, let's rewrite this equation into an equation that does not have fixed effects. How do you get rid of fixed effects in a regression equation? You take the first difference. That's one of the ways. There are other ways, but they took a difference. So if you take the difference over t, where t is the period of time, then assuming that nothing happens to your productivity goes away. And what you see is the relationship between changes in your own performance as a function of changes in the average productivity of the people who are around you. And the parameter in this function, beta, will give you the strength of the peer effects. That's how they would proceed. Now, what is the complication here? The obvious complication is that you observe this, because that's the number of clicks per second or per minute, whatever, right? But you do not observe this. You do not observe this. You need to calculate it. Now, how do you calculate it? Theta is the fixed effect, is the individual fixed effect. Individual fixed effects are not observed. They need to be calculated. Now, how do you calculate individual fixed effects? Well, you calculate the individual fixed effects from a form of equation 16 that is generalized. So here, equation 16 says your output is a function of your fixed effect plus some function of the average productivity of the people around you. This equation tells us your output is a function of your productivity plus whatever factors that are influenced by the composition of people who you work with. So, what is rho ci here? Rho ci is the set of dummy variables for all possible combinations of co-workers in a given store. See what I mean? So suppose we are the four workers in the supermarket, or five workers in the supermarket, right? Tabea, Florian, Felix, Hannes. So Tabea, Florian, Felix, Hannes, and Nick. Okay, so let's see. Now there are five of us, and we work in shifts of, let's say, three workers. Okay, so there are different. At any time we need three workers. There are five on the staff. So what are the different combinations of three workers from the five cashiers that we can have? We can have Nick, Tabea, Florian. That's combination number one. We can have Nick, Florian, Felix. We can have Nick, Felix, Hannes. We can have Nick, Hannes, Florian, etc. Right? So there are lots of combinations. How many combinations are there, by the way? How many combinations of three out of five? It's the 5 times 4 times 3 divided by 1 times 2 times 3, right? So it's 10, I think. Yeah? 10. So in this example that I gave, right? In this example that I gave, you're going to have a set of 10 minus 1, 9 dummy variables. Each dummy variable for a particular possible combination in which a worker can work. See what I mean? You see the idea? Right? So, and whatever the effect of a particular combination of co-workers in which the worker works is going to be controlled here. So what remains is the error term. You have some control variables, which aren't very interesting, and the precious worker fixed effect. So when I have performance records, when Mas and Moretti have performance records of us, of all of us individually, and they know at which point in time each of us worked with the other workers, this equation can be estimated and all our individual fixed effects can be calculated. So they take this fixed effect, they take these fixed effects, and they estimate equation 17 with the fixed effects that are estimated in this equation, from this equation. Is it clear? You understand what I'm talking about? Great. So now, one first question that you might ask is, okay, well, how different are people in terms of their productivity? Maybe they're all the same. Maybe they're all clicking about the same speed, in which case it's tough luck, because when people have the same productivity, it's very hard to estimate peer effects. Now, when you look at the estimated thetas, their average is, of course, zero by construction, as all fixed effects would be. But the standard deviation is 9%. What it means, standard deviation of 9% in output, it means that if you move one standard deviation up the productivity distribution, your output will increase by 9%. So, which is quite a substantial number. Okay, some regressions. Very basic. Very basic. When you regress the delta own productivity on delta average theta of the people around you, you'll have a coefficient of 0.15. So what it means? It means if you work in a shift that is 10% more productive than your previous shift on average, then your output will go up by how much? By how much will your output go up if you work in a 10% more productive shift than the previous one? By how much? 1.5. Look, delta output equals beta times delta productivity. If the productivity in your shift goes up by 10%, by how much will your output increase? Your own output. Beta, 0.15, times 10% increase. So it's 1.5%, right? So that's what this coefficient means. And then they throw in some controls, and here they throw in other controls. So all these specifications are not very important. Their details are here. And the important thing is that this effect is pretty robust. Now, the next interesting result we see is this, is column 4. What is so interesting in this result? The most interesting coefficient in the set of results in column 4 is this. Change in the average productivity times the dummy variable, which takes the value of 1 if this change is positive. So, back to my question. Let's imagine two situations. First, you worked in a very productive group of people. So suppose Felix works with Nick, Florian, and Tabea, and Nick, Florian, and Tabea are super productive cashiers. So Felix's output is high. Now suppose Tabea leaves, Nick leaves, and there's Florian and Johannes. And these guys take it easy. They're not very productive. So the average productivity of workers around Felix has gone down by 10%. My question is, Felix, given that the productivity of people around you went down by 10%, by how much will your productivity increase or decrease as a result of it? Your productivity will increase by 0.03 because it's minus 0.03 times minus 0.01, minus 0.1. But it's not statistically significant, as you can see. Right? So nothing will happen to your productivity if the productivity of people around you goes down. You will become just as productive as before. Not significantly different. Okay. Now imagine that the productivity of the people around you, Felix, the productivity of the people around you goes up by 10%. By how much will your productivity increase or decrease? Or will it stay the same? So 10% to you, so you're now in an environment where workers are on average 10% more productive. By how much will your output increase? According to the results in column 4. So by 2.4%. Okay, so your productivity will not really change if you are in a worse environment. And it will improve by 2.4% if you're in a better environment. Okay? Now, how do you relate these findings with the findings that we previously reported? This is the average of these two guys. It's the average of them. Well, some sort of average, weighted average. Yeah.
As intuition, if you let good, productive people work with one guy, he will raise his output.
Yeah.
If you then take them back,
he
won't lower that.
Exactly.
Because of this has nothing to do with learning.
This we will discover later. It's not clear what it has to do with. So far it's just pure statistics. We don't know what the mechanism is. It's just results. It's just what happens in the data. We still need to understand what's going on. But yeah, so what happens is, if you are thrown into a bad environment, your productivity does not suffer. But if you're thrown into a better environment than before, your productivity increases. So that's great. What do we learn from it as personnel managers? What do we learn from it? What is the immediate implication for management from this result? Exactly. Select top workers and send them to underperforming teams. And don't be afraid to withdraw these workers and send them to next underperforming teams. It may be naive. But the implication from this data is precisely this.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, they are doing this. They are doing this. I cannot say about this in the live mode on the video because it's sort of private information. But I have been talking to various firms about their various management practices. And some firms have told me that they do have these so-called excellence teams where they sent either teams or individually very high productive workers to currently underperforming workplaces or underperforming teams, underperforming locations. They rotate it this way. And of course, they don't do it on permanent basis, they do it precisely on temporary basis. So they would send, a good qualified worker to help struggling team for maybe 2 weeks or a month, and then this worker will go back. And the idea is there. The idea is that this good worker will come and, make these guys work and would leave. Now, back to your question, Florian. Your question was, is it learning? Or is it some sort of non-symmetric curious peer effects? We know that peer effects are not symmetric. How do we know that peer effects are not symmetric? From Falcon de Quino's model, we see that the effects of peer pressure are different depending on the theta. So they will be different for people of different productivities. We know that peer effects are not symmetric. And here we see that peer effects are not symmetric in another important sense, that the negative peer effects are not there or not significantly there, whereas the positive peer effects are very much there, at least in this form. Okay, so that's what we learned. And now let's talk about the mechanisms. Let's see whether it's learning or some curious peer effects or maybe something else. Right. So, now, what are the mechanisms behind spillovers? What are the mechanisms behind spillovers? One mechanism behind spillovers is social pressure. We saw it in the first lecture on peer effects. Remember when we were talking about Solomon Asch and his experiments, right? So when the hired actors managed to persuade, genuine experiment participants that line number two was equal to the length of the reference line. So there could be social pressure, okay? And social pressure is very much a possibility in this environment because the work of cashiers in supermarkets exhibits very strong complementarities, you know? And to imagine these complementarities, next time you go to supermarket, remember this. It's very easy, right? So you have cash tills, 1, 2, 3, whatever, right? Now, if you have a lazy cashier, what does it mean? It means there's more work for the others, okay? And these cashiers see the lazy one and will, you know, admonish them and tell them to work harder, right? So it's very much an issue here. So we can tell an interesting story that it's very much an issue here, but it's not a proof that this is actually the mechanism that's going to happen. So let's try to identify the empirical signature of this mechanism, if you like. Let's try to identify the pattern that we should see in the data that would be consistent with this mechanism. So what do you absolutely need to turn on social pressure? You need observability, right? You need people to know who is the lazy one. Because if people don't know who is the lazy one, how do they decide, right? So the mechanism of social pressure requires observability of effort and can be identified by looking at the productive workers entering the shift and those whose actions this worker observes, okay? So you need observability of effort. How do you know whose effort is observed and whose effort is not observed? Fortunately, in a supermarket environment, it's very easy to do. How do cashiers sit in a supermarket? They sit a bit like students here. So here's Felix, whose desk is number one. Here's Florian, whose desk is number two. Tabea, can you temporarily sit here? So, this is Tabea, cashier number three. This is Nick, cashier number four. Okay, so, Felix, whose performance can you observe?
I can see
all of us. Florian, whose performance can you observe? Can you observe Felix's performance? Okay, so you can't say. You can say who is the lazy one of us, but you will not be able to detect Felix shirking, right? I don't know. Tabea, you can observe only me. So if I'm the lazy one, you will tell me. But if these guys are lazy ones, you won't detect it. And I cannot observe anyone. Okay? So if there is social pressure, then we should see different peer effects depending on who observes whom. See what I mean? So There are the so-called. So let's look at the results. There is the observing set. There is the observing set, and there is the observable set. So make a note in your lecture, in your lectures. What is the observing set? So the observing set are the set of people who can observe your productivity. In our example, Tabea, you really have a preference for sitting there, right? For the sake of science, you couldn't remain there, could you? Right. It doesn't matter. So it was just my flat joke. Who is the observing set? Okay, Tabea is out. Tabea is taking days off. Now there are three cashiers in the supermarket. Okay, now, can you tell me who is the observing set for Nick? Who is in the observing set for Nick? No, everybody is in the observing set for Nick. Because two people can observe Nick's performance. Yes, observing set are the people who can observe your performance. Right. Now, and who is in the observable set for Nick? No one. That's right. So for Florian, Felix is in the observing set, and Nick is in the observable set. Okay. So Florian can see how hard Nick works. Nick can't see how hard Florian works. Florian can't see how hard Felix works. Felix can observe Nick's and Florian's performance. Okay. Now, if there is social pressure, what would you expect? You would expect people in the observing set to affect the performance of the guys in their observable set, right? Because, you know, if Felix is a hard-working cashier and he observes a lazy Florian and Nick, he will come to them and tell, guys, you really should work harder because, look, you're not fast enough. Or Felix will just shout at Florian and Nick during their joint session in the supermarket. And Florian and Nick, they will hear Felix breathing behind their neck, telling them, tempo, 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 tempo. And they will work harder. Okay? So, and that's what you see. And that's precisely what you see. You see that your productivity, Nick's productivity in this case, is positively affected by the productivity of the guys in the observing set. That is, by the productivity of Florian and Felix. Okay? But the productivity of Florian and Felix is not affected by the productivity of Nick, who is in the observable set from them. Do you see what I mean? So, Florian, it's not learning. It's not learning. It doesn't matter how high or low my productivity is, even though you could see my productivity. What does matter is how productive are the guys who can observe you, because then they will tell you. Right? Yeah, he could, you know, if he observes us, he could tell us, guys, you know, you're not really very productive, so you should work harder. And we could say, look, Felix, we are dying at this job already. We're doing our best, but we are not as productive as you are. And then Felix would say, okay, I will show you a few tricks. I will show you that, for example, when you have 10 bottles of beer, you don't have to scan each of them individually. You can just scan once and multiply by 10. And we say, oh, wonderful, what a great trick. And then we'll become more productive. So that's learning, of course. So, yeah, there could be learning, but it's not learning by observation. It's learning that happens through the agency of the people in the observing set. So far, we have clearly social pressure, and we also have maybe a little bit of learning. But the learning that we have still occurs through the agency of the guys in the observing set. Yeah? So, now, You could have different learning. You could have learning by means of knowledge spillovers. What are knowledge spillovers? Let's see. So, knowledge spillovers. Let's go back to this 10 beer bottles trick that I mentioned just now. So, productive workers have more knowledge of the work and can communicate this to others. This mechanism implies geographic localization of spillovers and can be tested by looking at how peer effects change with distance between workers. Now, let's say, okay, we are willing to learn. Yeah. Now, but learning is location specific, right? So suppose Tabea sits here and she's really great at, you know, all these cashier tricks to make the work faster. So you sit here. I'm not asking you because you so much prefer that desk, right? I don't want to move you. So imagine Tabea sits here and Felix is really having a problem learning the cashier tricks. So Felix is low productive, Tabea is high productive. Okay. Will there be a correlation between Tabea's productivity and Felix's productivity and Felix's output? Very little, if any, because they don't see each other. Right? If you think you want to learn, if you think you will learn, you need to see what she's doing. Of course, you could talk in the staff room, but you know, most of the learning is done on the job. Yeah? So now imagine Tabea is now relocated and she's sitting right here. Then you're going to learn a lot. Okay? So if there is knowledge spillovers, is there learning through, imitating best practices of the workers, then you should see different strengths of peer effects depending on how far away the workers are from each other. Okay, so you should see different correlations, different magnitudes of correlation between own output and peer productivity, depending on how far away these peers are located in the shop room. And that's what you see. So this is the observing set, that is the people who can observe and who are sit close to you. Very high correlation. These are the people who sit close to you and are in the observable set. Right? So no correlation. Observing set, sitting far away, positive correlation, not so strong, but still. Observable set and sit far away, no correlation. Right? So this is a pattern, a very characteristic strong pattern. Let's try to interpret it. So, peer effects are stronger as the distance between workers gets closer. How do we know this? By comparing 6 and 11. This is the strength of peer effects when workers are close to each other. This is the strength of peer effects when workers are not are far away from each other. So, yeah, okay, great. There is some indication that knowledge spillovers occur. However, most of the productivity spillovers is explained by social pressure. Why? Because there are no productivity spillovers in the observable set. There are productivity spillovers in the observing set. What does it mean? It means that it doesn't matter where Tabea sits. As long as she sits in the observable set for Felix, Felix is not going to learn anything from Tabea. He doesn't have to. He'll take it easy. He has a great place. No one observes his productivity. Now imagine, Tabea, you sit there. Felix is sitting here. And Felix is really a slow one. Tabea observes it. And she approaches Felix and says, Felix, you have to work harder. And Felix says, oh, sorry, Tabea, I can't, you know, I really do my best. And Tabea said, oh, yeah, look, you can do these, you could check out 10 beer bottles at once or 10 yogurt cartons at once and. So there is, it's a combination. There is social pressure because Tabea tells Felix to work harder and learning also happening through social pressure because Felix says, I want to learn, but I don't know. I want to work hard, but I don't know. So Tabea not only shouts at Felix, she also shows Felix how to be an efficient cashier. As long as Tabea is in the observing set, you see strong peer effects. But if Tabea is in the observable set, Felix doesn't care. So learning requires social pressure to initiate. See what I mean? Yeah. Right. Now,
this is made with cashiers, and this is a lot of coordinated skills and less of mental cognitive abilities.
Yeah.
And so learning won't be do that big part in that area, but
in which area? In the cashier job.
Yeah, in the cashier job. Uh-huh. Has it been made with other jobs as well?
Maybe. It's quite possible, but we only have the story about cashiers. But even with cashiers, there is learning.
But I think not that much.
Not that much, no. So, hypothetically, of course, I mean, I agree. I mean, I am, my job is different from cashiers. And I learn a lot from my colleagues on the other side of the Atlantic. I don't need to, you know, they don't need to see me. I don't need to see them. I think even for jobs requiring higher amounts of cognitive skills, I think there's an interesting interaction between social pressure and learning, which is totally underexplored. We think naively that everybody is super willing to learn to get better. No, not always. Not always. Sometimes you need to be pushed through social pressure to learn to get better. Right? So I can tell you a few stories from my research or practice where I screwed up and colleagues on the other side of the Atlantic noticed it by my Dropbox records. And they told me, "No, Nick, you've screwed up." I said, "Oh, show me how to do it better." And they would show me how to do better. So I would be cashier in the observing set for the Atlantic, right? Now, when I saw their Dropbox activity, I may or may not be willing to learn from them. So it requires, learning requires some pressure to be more effective. That's the story, which I think is pretty universal and goes beyond the narrow focus of this study. But, right, okay. Okay, right, so we have learning, we have social pressure, but most importantly what we have is a combination of learning and social pressure. Other mechanism, pro-social preferences. Pro-social preferences, this is the mechanism that receives the least empirical support. So, what is pro-social preferences? Altruism, competitive spirit, willingness to learn, willingness to help, enthusiasm, malaise, all sorts of sentiments that apply to the public, right? Apply to the group as a whole, right? Now, if you want to identify these mechanisms, you should see you should again go back to this observing versus observable set. And if you think that pro-social preferences are the mechanism behind peer effects, what you should see is a correlation between the performance of the people in the observable set and the own performance. I can only get enthused or depressed or encouraged when I see someone doing something. Remember the leading by example story, right? But what you see is in the observable set, there is really no correlation between the productivity of people in the observable set and the productivity of people in the observing set. So suppose, you know, there's Felix and everybody's in the observable set for him, but Felix is in the observing set for nobody. Now, Tabea is having really a great day. She is laughing, she's talking to customers, she's wishing nice holidays to everybody. The German team had won in the parallel universe. And she's, you know, clicking and clicking and clicking and is super productive and the shop is really doing great. Felix can't be bothered. Right? So, There's no enthusiasm and contagion. There's no social preferences that among the mechanisms that shape the peer effects. The mechanism that shape the peer effects is, I stress, a combination of social pressure and learning that takes social pressure to activate. Okay, that's basically what I wanted to say. There's some practical lessons which are pretty obvious. Let's quickly go through them and have a break, and then we're back to with the Q&A, okay? So, important role of peer effects in the workplace. You don't get a social multiplier of 14 to 15% for nothing very often. So there is people's performance affects each other, okay? Now, clever managers can take advantage of it by forming teams of people of different ability and different performance in a clever way so as to enable positive peer effects from high-performing people to low-performing people. Okay, so that's the example from that's the lesson from Falcon Di Quino and Massimo Moretti together. Now, the other lesson from Massimo Moretti is, well, okay, if you just put people of different productivities together in a team, then what's going to happen? Is it that low performers will learn from high performers, or low performers will get enthusiastic looking at high performers and will start working harder themselves? Or will it that high performers will challenge the low performers and tell them to work harder? It turns out that it's the high performers challenging the low performers, telling them to work harder, and showing them how to work harder, how to be more productive. That's what's going to happen. Now, only if there is possible to exert social pressure and learning initiated by social pressure, only then can you talk about effective management of peer effects in the workplace. If, on the other hand, you put together a low-performing worker and a well-performing worker in the team, the well-performing worker comes to the low-performing worker and tells them, look, you have to work harder. The low-performing worker tells the high performer to sod off, I don't care. You're not the authority to me, and I don't care about your social pressure. Then that's not going to, then nothing's going to happen, right? So if you're going to put good pupils together with bad pupils in the project, the good pupils will come to bad pupils and say, guys, we really have to work hard. The bad pupils will say to good people, you know what, nerd, you can get lost. I don't care. And then you don't see positive peer effects very strongly, right? So peer effects themselves are important, but their importance is determined to a large extent by the social context in which they happen. And the two important elements of this social context is the possibility to exert social pressure and the possibility to learn from each other. So these are the ideas that I want to leave you with. Let's have a break and reconvene for Q&A. Thank you. Give me recognition!